Once more unto the breach, dear friends, else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning again, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and this is Jake McClure speaking. Jeff is still off enjoying the much cooler weather of Colorado. We've defined success for anyone in Texas as not being in Texas in August. So he took a big chunk of August off and a big chunk of September off. He'll be up there having a good time for a while longer, although his version of a good time is the laid-back, relaxed kind. All right, so what is this program? This is the Personal Wealth Coach. I'm Jake McClure. As I said, I'm usually joined by Jeff McClure, known as Old Baldy and Young Baldy. I am the Young Baldy. You can generally tell us apart by the color of our beards on the program. His is white and mine is much darker, though it's more white than it used to be. The Personal Wealth Coach is also a SEC registered investment advisory firm. What does that mean? It means it's a fiduciary firm that's registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission. They don't approve of us in any way. It's not like a pat on the head. They're our regulator and we have to register with them. They don't approve of anything. They do very clearly, and they make it well known when they disapprove of things, and that's an important factor. There's some major news out in the world today having to do with that. We advertise, as that firm advertises on this radio station. We don't pay for the radio program. They don't pay us to do the radio program. So that's a side note. They've had us doing this radio program for, I think there have been five owners of the studio since we started. And so I've been doing this since 1998, the end of it. So I got to, for my first year in radio, discussing the economy, economics, and how money works, which I'm not sure how much I knew back then, but enough that I could sound semi-intelligent, which... that's a warning for all of you out there. Someone that sounds semi-intelligent may be just covering up. Anyway, it's my first year, I got to cover in depth the Y2K problem and what it could do to the country. And it's become an anecdotal piece of wisdom that I've held ever since, is that at the end of the Y2K problem, when there really wasn't that big a problem, it was all solved in advance. The national outcry for all the money that was spent on preventing the problem that wasn't actually a problem because all the money was spent on it. And that little piece of wisdom is that it's really, really hard to figure out what would have happened if we hadn't taken preventative action. You can always say nothing would have happened, and there's no way to prove you wrong. So that doesn't mean we should not wear our seatbelts. I'm going to be talking about the stock market, what's going on in the economy in just a minute, but I have a caller already. So caller on 773-1400, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Good morning to you. I was wanting to ask you this question. You know, usually on all currency, you usually have the President of the United States on these currencies. Why is it that on the $100 bill they put Benjamin Franklin on there and he never was the President of the United States? You have a good day, sir.
All right. Appreciate it. Politics. That is the way of the world. There are quite a few faces on coins, the dollar coins and the paper money, that in the past have not been presidents. Presidents just seem to be the most remarkable figures in American history for most people. So it's just a matter of popularity. Who wants what on the face? So whether it's Harriet Tubman, Alexander Hamilton, Ben Franklin, you don't have to be a president to be on the currency of the United States. That is a kind of an interesting thought process. Why is Ben Franklin on there? Well, on the $100 bill? Well, let me tell you real easily. He was vastly wealthy. He was a very successful person, owned a lot of newspapers in the colonies and back in Europe. He had connections all over the world. He was an inventor. He did a lot of amazing things for the world in general. The fact that we are where we are has a lot of credit and blame can go to him. So he's the one that came up with the positive and negative charges on electrons. You know, that's pretty awesome, except he got them backwards, at least on the symbols. So it's a fascinating thing. He didn't know it was backwards. He just applied those things, and you can dig into that. That's worth it. The humor of it is worth the time. All right. So what happened this week in the market? The S&P 500, that's an index that we track most regularly. And we can talk about what indexes are later in the program if you guys want. I've got some other stuff lined up. But the fact that we're using the S&P 500, it's just because it holds the 500 biggest publicly traded companies, roughly the biggest 500 companies in the United States on the stock market. So it's a pretty good indicator of what's happening on the stock market as a whole. If they're smaller than that, you can have different stuff. So that's why you see the NASDAQ not exactly mimicking the S&P 500. It's got a lot more companies in it, a lot more small of the smaller companies as well. So the Dow Jones Industrial Average only has 30 companies in it, and they're going to be really, really big companies. So you're going to see differences in these moving in these averages as they go up and down. Well, the S&P 500, that's our preferred method. It's a pretty good statement about what's going on in the market in general. For the week ending Friday, it was up 1.79%. It closed at 2,978.71. That means it's up almost 4% from 12 months ago, 3.71. Because the peak of the market, if we go back to the peak, we're down still. So subtracting the last 12 months inflation of a little bit below 2%, about 1.8%, the real return was almost 2% in the market, which means people in high yield savings positions at a bank may have gotten a higher interest rate. What caused the market to be up at the end of the week? Well, this is the same thing that causes it to be down throughout the week at different times, is the trade war. Rumors out that there's going to be more negotiation. Now, why do I call it a rumor when it's kind of an official announcement? Because official announcements don't mean what they used to. And this kind of negotiation, it's very freewheeling. And just because they say they're going to meet for negotiations doesn't mean it's actually going to happen. So we're seeing a lot of uncertainty in the market. We're seeing a lot of volatility. It's up, it's down, it's up, it's down. It's been relatively flat. For all the movement up and all the movement down, it's been relatively flat over the last year. And if you apply inflation to the savings position, you actually come back to about zero. So high yield savings is paying you just about the rate of inflation. There was a good example a moment ago of comparing apples and oranges. And I did it on purpose because I've heard this stated to me several times from different people. The S&P 500 over the last 12 months is up 3.71%. Okay. Take away inflation. That's been running about 1.8%. They only got about 1.9% on their money, and this is people that are strictly in the S&P 500. I could have done better in the bank. Well, then you look at the bank, and the very, very best high-yield savings positions that I see around are about 2.3%. Well, you got to remember to take inflation out of that, too. So you're almost at zero for the same time period. The reality is that there is no place that you can make money all the time. People used to say that about government bonds, just government bonds in general, except now we've got negative interest rates all over the planet. They're not in the United States yet, but that doesn't mean they won't be. There's nothing to prevent them from being here. So there is no place you can go that is risk-free that means you will always make money, period. People need to really think about that, because there's this thought that if they just do the right thing consistently, it will work. Well, the definition of the right thing changes with time. What is the right vehicle and so on? All right, so what is going on with the rest of the market? West Texas Intermediate, that's the United States version of the oil price, rather than Brent. Brent crude is what the rest of the world gauges their oil prices on. The oil prices were up 2.8% this week, closed at $56.52 a barrel. There, the oil prices are up on hopes that the Federal Reserve will continue to cut interest rates. We've got rumors on that too. Looks like we're going to have some more interest rate cuts this year. So there's a lot of rumors, and that's really what's defining the market right now. And what I'm going to say is get used to that for a while. Even if we have a resolution to the trade situation, we're in a presidential election cycle, which means that the quality of information, the fact-checking on information that's going out through usually rigorously fact-checked channels is going to drop. We're going to get a lot of stuff that is just opinion stated as fact. And you should just know that going into this. It's not unusual. People seem to get incensed about this every time it happens. But this is the old joke about politicians. How do you know when they're lying? Their mouth is moving. So just be aware that a lot of bad news is going to be flowing around. And this is not necessarily the best time for bad news to be hitting, but it might be. So let's talk about, you know, we've for about 12 months now, we've been making some big warnings about future recessions based on coming sooner, based on the trade war, and the data's been coming in, and it sounds like this dire prediction. It sounds like we're talking about doom and gloom. And I had a client ask me about, are we going to have another Great Depression in 2020? I've been hearing about the Great Depression. Let's start. This is a really good opportunity to talk about what causes recessions. What is a recession anyway? What causes it? Are they bad? So in a political cycle, this is something I'm going to throw it out there and get it out of the way at the beginning. In a political cycle, recessions are bad for a sitting president. So politics is going to weigh in on this. It's going to be a factor. We can set it aside for now, but just know if the economy gets better, the president's going to claim credit for it. And if the economy gets worse, the Democrats are going to blame the president for it. This happens no matter, you know, it won't be the Democrats, but no matter who's president, whether it's Ronald Reagan or George W. Bush or Bill Clinton, it doesn't matter. The opposing party is going to lay blame for the economy at the feet of the president, and the president is going to take credit for the booms in the economy. Very rarely do they actually deserve the credit and the blame. Okay. So let's take that and set it aside for a second. What causes a recession? Are they good? And it's kind of like saying, is the cold virus good? Well, if we could make our immune system strong enough that we never got the cold virus, would that be a good thing? And there's a lot of evidence to show that having viruses throughout your life and fighting them off helps prevent things like cancer and makes you possibly live longer. So the negative things that abrade us make us more efficient sometimes. If they're too big, they can kill us. So we got to walk this narrow path. What is a recession? Well, this is going to be amazing. There's no official definition for a recession. There is one group, the INBER. Let me give you their acronym. INBER.org, NBER. They used to go by what their acronym stood for, which is the National Bureau of Economic Research. Now people just say INBER, and they expect you to know what the heck that means. INBER says it's a recession. They're the group. It's not a governmental organization. It's a private organization. It's not for profit that looks at a lot of data and says whether or not we're in a recession. Well, who gave them that mantle? Who said, you guys are the ones that get to say this? Easy answer. They did. Anybody can claim it's a recession at any time. Anybody can claim a lot of things because we don't have an official definition of what that is. We have a commonly used definition. A recession is two quarters, so half a year of, this is the academic term, negative growth in GDP. Negative growth. That's a silly economics term. A negative growth just means shrinkage. We're going backwards, not forward. It doesn't mean we've got slow growth. It doesn't mean slowing growth. It doesn't mean we're at break even. It means we're actually cutting back in the things that we're doing. That is receding. Now, it used to be that it was two quarters in a row of that, and we would say that's a recession. For the Great Recession, we counted an extra quarter back. So we had a quarter of negative growth, a quarter of growth, and then two quarters of negative growth. And Inber said, include that first negative quarter growth, even though we had growth the following quarter. We're going to call it all a recession. That's okay. All right. It's not a quibble. If we're looking at how long has the patient been sick, they really started getting sick back here, but seemed to be getting better, and now they're sick again. Well, the doctor might say it started back here. The reality is that the economy is not a sickness. It isn't healthy or unhealthy. The economy is how we move money around. And so I'm going to kind of approach starting at the end of a recession, what leads to the next recession typically. So you're coming out of this recession. Maybe you're an existing business, or maybe you are a startup. You lost your job in the recession and you started up a new business. And incidentally, that's when a lot of new businesses get started, is in recessions. So hold that in mind on the pro column instead of the con column. The pros and cons of a recession. A lot of new businesses get started in recessions. The reason why they got started is usually negative, but it can be a really big positive on the overall economy long term. Okay, so you have a business, and maybe it existed before, maybe it's new. You start selling something to people. You may be making the thing and selling it to someone who sells it. You may be making it and selling it yourself. That's pretty rare these days. Just think of any place you've been recently that manufactures and sells their own goods at the same facility. There are some furniture shops that do it there, but if you really go down, car companies, definitely not. You just think of all the places that you could go that build and sell at the same time. Houses. You could go to a home builder. They manufacture the thing and sell it right there. Okay. So whether it's manufacturing or sales, it doesn't really matter. So we could be a combination of those or either. You're making something or you're selling something. The things that are required to make the thing that you're selling at the end of the last recession tend to be relatively cheap, because there's not a big demand out there for them, because the economy's not in great shape. People aren't buying like crazy. So you've got some good deals on your raw materials or maybe some finished components that you put together to create something. So you're able to offer a really good price point. You come out with a new product at a good price point, and assuming that the product gets popular, people start buying it. Now, this is where things truly start separating. If you really get successful, companies tend to separate their manufacturing from their sales. So we said earlier, it's pretty rare for them to be together in the same spot. Well, if you're a startup, that's usually how it goes. You're making the thing on site and selling it either on site or online. You're intensely involved in every step of the manufacturing process and sales process. That gets separated out, because if the phone's ringing and you're in the middle of finishing up the last quirky little bit of one manufacturing thing and you have to answer the phone to sell it, It's going to take you longer to do both. So you hire a sales team. The sales team doesn't want to sit in the manufacturing room. So they start separating out. The sales team is no longer intricately familiar with the manufacturing process. They are familiar with their goals, which are sales numbers. What did we do last year? What are we planning on doing this year? What are our aspirations for next year? So that's sales. Okay, so far I'm just describing how businesses work. As the sales numbers go up, the sales force is completely missing a couple of key points of information almost always. Number one, how long does the product last? If you're selling a refrigerator, you shouldn't expect a repeat customer in the next 6 months. When should you have a repeat customer? Well, if you're doing your job right, if you're making a product that is a high quality product, you may not see that repeat customer for 15 years on a refrigerator. What about a smartphone? Well, if you sold the smartphone to somebody, how long does the product last? Well, you might want another one in 2 years. 2 or 3 years is typically the lifespan of a smartphone. Okay, but at the beginning, there's no smartphones out there. So the entire marketplace is open. If you're in sales and all you're looking at is the growth curve of your sales numbers, but you're not looking at the size of your marketplace or the durability of your product, it can put you right out of business as soon as you completely sold to everybody in your marketplace. It doesn't matter how great your product is. If you've sold one to everyone and they only need one, your sales numbers are not going to keep on growing at the same rate. So you've saturated the market. And then you might expect to see your sales numbers maintain. If you gain market share, you might get a boost in sales numbers. But if you think about this, how many smartphones do you need? So at the beginning, their sales numbers have this like rocket ship look on the graphs because they've got to sell to everybody that doesn't have this thing, whatever it is. If you're a new business in a town that's never seen your business before and you're going out and you're meeting the people and you're convincing everyone how much they need your product, if your product has a lifespan that's longer than a year, you shouldn't buy lots of inventory on the initial sales numbers. So you've got this rocket ship sales growth. Wow, this is amazing. If you're in a small town and now you've sold your product to everybody who's interested in that town, if you keep buying more inventory, it will put you out of business because nobody's going to be there to buy it. You can't expect people to get rid of a very durable item in the first year to trade up. People don't do that regularly unless they're just really wealthy. It's a different category of people altogether. As you're moving forward, this business is coming out of the recession, you're hiring more people, your sales numbers are great, you're hiring more salespeople, you're hiring more manufacturing because you've got to build these products fast enough to keep up with the sales demand. And the people doing the hiring are trying to make projections. They're saying, are we going to need this person next year? But at some point, the desperateness, the absolute panic on the face of the other people in the manufacturing facility saying, we need more people, causes the hiring to proceed. Okay, we've got to meet the demand that we've got. Let's build more. We'll get there. As this happens, it's not happening in its own little universe. Other businesses are experiencing the same things. They're growing up out of a recession. At first, they start lean and mean. There is no fat to be trimmed because it is on a shoestring budget. We just left the recession. Maybe it's a new business. Maybe it's an old business. But we survived. So we're going forward. And all of these businesses are growing on that same kind of pattern. Well, that means that at the beginning, the parts that you were ordering to make your end product were cheap because demand was low for them. Whether it's pure raw materials or components, you were just about the only person at the time buying those things. So the prices were low. as the economy continues to recover, more and more people want those products to build their equipment, to build their things. And you want more of it because your sales are up. So everybody's buying more of those things. What does it do to the price? Prices start up. This is the typical maturation process of an economy. The prices start up because more people are demanding them. You start hiring up all the people, so the wages start going up. It means that eventually you're going to have to raise the price of your product. You want to hold off on that as long as possible. You want to eke out as much of the profit as you can on the lower price, because you raise the price and you're going to get fewer people buying. The extra price might make up the difference, but fewer people buying means fewer people that could buy later. And I'm going to put this on pause for a moment because I've got another caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Enjoy the show. There was an article today in the Wall Street about state investor protection rules step in. I know there's been a couple of false starts at the federal level for fiduciary, but how many states have got state rules that that are in place now, and is Texas one of them? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. Appreciate it. All right. Let me kind of broadly cover this to begin with to give some background. What is fiduciary? Fiduciary means a professional that's required to work in the best interest of their customer. They're required to disclose all their fees, say this is how I'm compensated, here's all the other ways I get compensated, and then put the customer first. Legally, they're required to put the customer first. This is a standard that has, over time, been a very small percentage of the professionals in the world. Doctors fall in this category in that they're not supposed to have some kind of compensation associated with the treatment plan for a patient. It should be a flat compensation based no matter which way you go on a treatment for a patient. Just to avoid conflicts of interest. Attorneys are supposed to be the same way. Hire an attorney, they are supposed to put you above themselves and you definitely above everybody else. And it's called malpractice when the doctor or the attorney don't do it that way. It's the same in the financial world. Now, back in 2006, the Pension Protection Act was passed. Pension Protection Act was passed under a Republican Congress with a Republican president. So that's just to pull out. This isn't the Dodd-Frank bill that came after the recession, which was done by Democrats under a Democrat president. So you've got two flavors of how do we protect the public. One flavor is the Pension Protection Act. The other is the Dodd-Frank. This is the one that said let's figure out what rules to put on banks to make sure they're not overlending and stress tests and new responsibilities for the Federal Reserve. Okay, so we've got these two laws. The Pension Protection Act says to the Labor Department, hey, you've got to come up with a definition for fiduciary and determine if you so choose whether or not to apply it. So that's kind of vague. So the Labor Department, why would they have the job of figuring out what fiduciary is? Labor Department, isn't that for like employment stuff? They're the ones that talk about unemployment numbers. What do they have to do with this? Very simply, they're the ones in charge of regulating 401ks, 403bs, any employer-sponsored retirement plan is theirs. They get to say, hey, this has to be done right. Who enforces it for them? Because the Labor Department doesn't show up at the door with a SWAT team. I don't think they have a SWAT team. I shouldn't say that too loudly, or every department's probably got a SWAT team somewhere. Okay, so Labor Department, who enforces for them? The SEC does. FINRA, which is the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, helps to enforce things. They do it under the auspices of their work with the SEC. The IRS. The IRS is probably the biggest enforcer of the Labor Department standards because they're the ones that get the most benefit from enforcing it. If you're thinking about a 401k, if a company's not doing it right and they're getting tax deductions that they're not due, who's going to be in charge of following up on that? That's the IRS. Okay, so the Labor Department has been told by Congress, you need to come up with a clear and rational definition for what the fiduciary standard is, and then apply it where it's appropriate. In the process, they made the determination, hold on, this is too logical for government, but hold on to your seats because they did it. They made the determination that an individual retirement account should have the same safeguards as a 401k. I know, gasp, right? What do you mean? What difference has an IRA been from a 401k? They're both retirement money. They're both set aside, tax deferred, unless it's like a Roth, but Roth falls under both categories as well. They're set aside with special tax treatments for use in retirement. They have the same taxes and penalties applied if you take them out before retirement. They have the same benefits when it comes to a lot of the early retirement exclusions, so first-time home buyers and college, and there's a couple of things you can do to pull money out without paying a penalty. And so in a lot of ways, they're treated identically. The 401k can be rolled over into an IRA, and the money looks, acts, tastes, smells, and other things that money does the same. It's the same stuff. Except as soon as it leaves the 401k, the person giving you advice on it falls under a different standard. If you're working for a company, you have a 401k, your company can't tell you specifically to you, customized away from everyone else, how to invest your money. They can give you a brochure that's educational that says, fill out this questionnaire. It might help you determine this yourself. The reason is because they don't know all of the intricacies of your life, which is part of being a fiduciary. You got to understand the interests of the client before you can work in their best interests. If you've got 9,000 clients, there is no way you can know that unless you've gone algorithmically, which is what these, you know, you go in a 401k and they say, fill out this questionnaire and that will choose something for you. Okay. Soon as you go over to an IRA, the person giving you advice on where to put the money can fall under a whole series of different categories. Usually it falls under what's called the suitability category, which means that they've got to work in your good interest. Now, there's a difference between good interest and best interest. These are ethical people, the brokers and so on, by and large. I mean, when they're not ethical, hopefully we catch them and put them in jail or fine them and kick them out of the industry. The vast majority of people in the financial world are ethical. But they also have a profit motive. They're in business to make a living, and to make a profit is part of that. I mean, you are asking them to find companies for you that are making a profit. So the profit motive is there. The different standards have to do with how much you know about the profit motive. That's it. That's all it is. How much are you getting paid when I invest this money? That seems like it would be a pretty simple thing. That's what the big holdup is here. Because there's a lot of people that would say, I would love to work in the best interest of the client. But that means that they're going to have to take a pay cut. Because if they have two choices for the same mutual fund and one pays them more, which one are they going to choose if the client really doesn't know? They're going to choose the one that pays them more. And yeah, we've seen that. So the Labor Department came out with the fiduciary standard saying full disclosures, all this stuff. When did it come out with these rules? Well, over the years following 2006, so the first one, I believe the first version of it came out in 2008. But then there were other things on everybody's mind on the economy front rather than fiduciary standards. So then we didn't see a revised version of it for quite a few years after that. But they started peppering us. Here it is. We think this is the final version, all the way up to I guess it was 2017, the final rule was prepared to come out. It said that anyone giving advice on any kind of retirement product must be a fiduciary, period. Well, the insurance lobby is really big, and there's a lot of money in insurance products in IRAs. And they're saying, wait a minute, we don't claim to be brokers of lots and lots of different kinds of investment. We just sell the one thing. We're selling an annuity here, and if it's an IRA, why should it be different than anything else? So they spent a lot of money. There was a lot of lobbying, which is why the rule kept getting changed over and over again. It hit the courts, and the courts threw it out. Because, believe it or not, having an income and being in a position to make a profit with you is a form of free speech. So they get to say, unless it's voluntary, you can't force people to be fiduciaries. So now they're back to the drawing board at the Labor Department level. The SEC says, hey, we'll take it. We'll come up with a regulation. So they start spitting out regulations that keep getting slapped down. And now their latest version of it is called Regulation BI, or Best Interest. And it really doesn't cover a fiduciary standard. It talks about best interest, but all it's saying is a document that will tell you whether or not the person that's working for you is operating in your best interest. They've got it set so that the document can be very hard to read. So it's not forward progress in the essence of what was asked for by Congress in 2006. So that's stalled. The Labor Department's picking it back up. The SEC's best interest is being hammered by the lobbies of all the different big financial firms, because if they're in the sales business, they don't want to be in the best interest business. They want to be in the sales business. And that's a very clear statement. And they're basically going back to, hey, this is free speech stuff. If we're in a for-profit business and we don't want to tell the clients what we're charging them, that's up to the client. I don't think the client is well enough educated in most cases to make that decision. But the reality is that it's a lot harder to make a living as a fiduciary. You know, our firm functions as a fiduciary, and it's a lot harder. We have to take cases that have more money in it. Otherwise, we don't make any money. We have to approach that carefully. We do pro bono stuff. We're trying to increase education. But the reality is that you go out of business if you're taking very little cases, very small cases, and you're a fiduciary. It's just not sustainable. So that's what the industry is saying. People are going to lose what advice they already have. So now back to the question. There are some states that have taken it in their own hands. And then some of this has hit the news recently. The Wall Street Journal has been covering it kind of sporadically over the last few weeks, but it's been around. The number who are currently fiduciary, I'm not sure on the exact number, at least three, New Jersey, New York, and Connecticut. They're building some, there are quite a few others that are working on it. I believe Nevada's working on it. They may have already passed the law. But there's a lot of other legislatures that are working on it. And it's a standard that says if you are in our state and you are selling these products, you've got to say whether it's in the best interest of the client. Clearly, if it's not in the best interest of the client, you can't do it. I think the parts of the story that are getting the most traction are annuity sales in New York just dropped drastically with the passing of this law. What that should tell you is that annuities, life insurance agents and companies that are selling these annuities, they have been held to a standard. They say if you are giving a recommendation for an annuity, then you have to tell the client if there are other annuities from the same company that are cheaper, that have less fees, less commissions. So what that's done, here's the unintended consequence, the ripple effect. Many of the insurance companies, so the most prominent being Jackson National, has simply stopped offering, they've simply stopped offering their inexpensive products. Their cheap fiduciary styled products are no longer available in New York. well, why? You'd think with the fiduciary law, that would be the thing that people would be going to. No, because they're required to disclose if the product that they're selling you has another product available for cheaper. So which product do you think is more profitable for the insurance company? Let's just kind of game that out. Well, obviously the one that costs more is more profitable to the insurance company. So the law says they've got to disclose if they've got a cheaper version of that product available. So all they're doing is not offering that product anymore. The cheaper product is no longer on the table. So this is the law of unintended consequences. This is a good concept. How do we get the people that are investing to know what they're being charged, to know the nature of what it is that they're investing in? Well, this effort caused a series of really good intentions, caused good intentions to go awry. So this is very much like the fuel emission standards in California, where the fuel emission standards had been set at the federal level. California said, all right, we'll do that too. Then the federal level changed to a lower level, the fuel emission standards. And California said, no, we're going to just leave them up there. We might even crank them up a little higher. So who has the right here? Well, it's not been covered by law. We don't know. California has the right to say this is what we want done in California. That's states' rights stuff. The federal government has the right to say, oh, across the nation, here's the standard that we want. Now the federal government is looking at the auto industry in California and saying this might be antitrust. So how is this similar? It's a states' rights issue. And if they have the right to regulate inside their state, they have the right to regulate inside their state. This antitrust thing, the Justice Department is in charge. This is a completely different set of laws of making sure that we don't get a monopoly. That was the original intent. One company to rule them all, basically. This is based on U.S. Steel, Andrew Carnegie. He owned, in essence, within a very, very fine margin of being 100% of the steel manufacturing capability of the world. And there's something unhealthy about one person being that powerful. It puts other businesses out of business. It can cause the prices to go whatever way that person determines. It is very much like the diamond cornered market that existed for a long time by De Beers. It's no longer in that same state, but to some extent, it's still very much influenced by it. So antitrust is really important. It also prevents companies from price fixing. So if there's five companies that build the same item, you would expect that item to have a pretty good price because there's five companies competing with each other. They want your business. Unless they've been sending memos back and forth saying, hey, we don't want to go below nine. Why don't we just say nine's the bottom and we'll go from there? So everybody goes, oh yeah, nine's the bottom. That's a good idea. We don't want to go below nine either. Well, that's price fixing. That's a form of antitrust issue. Okay, so now California is talking to these auto dealers and saying we're going to require in the state of California that the emissions level be at this level. So the companies that are signed on to this say, all right, we're going to manufacture cars. We got to do it in California. We're going to do this. In essence, have an agreement amongst themselves to follow the law in California. And the Justice Department is saying, well, the law, the federal law kind of specifically mandates that you're not allowed to have an agreement to do something that's going to increase the price of your products. So once again, we're in a gray area. Probably in the court, this is going to have to get determined to say they weren't doing it on a profit motive. But that's not part of the law. It's not about profits. It's about price fixing. They are, in essence, price fixing by saying we're going to buy something more expensive to filter the air in our cars. And if everybody buys it, and if everybody's filtering their air at that same standard, it causes the minimum price for the car to go up. So it's based on, you know, the Californians are convinced that they're doing the right thing.
that they're trying to increase the air cleanliness. They don't want to have greenhouse gases or nasty pollution, and they're okay spending the extra money to have that. At least the majority of them are, or they wouldn't have elected these people. Then at the federal level, we have the opposite taking place. Hey, this is increasing the price of the goods too much to meet these standards. We're not talking about the moral or the ethical, although you can argue for both sides on this. The federal government right now is saying, hey, you're increasing the prices of automobiles and it's causing them to be less efficient. And I could easily point out that the ethanol, 10% ethanol in the gas does the same thing. So it's not supposed to be rational. These are two governments arguing with each other, and it's across party lines. The party lines are really what's going on here. The Republicans are arguing with the Democrats. And that's a problem. Figuring this out in a rational way that we believe to be the best for the country is important, and I think both the Republicans and the Democrats are approaching it with that in mind. Dirty tricks happen in those scenarios because both sides believe they're right. The fiduciary standard is exactly the same thing. The insurance companies want to offer cheaper products for people that have some other form of compensation going to a fiduciary. They want to say, hey, we're not going to charge a big commission and hand it off to the insurance agent because the insurance agent doesn't actually exist here. You've gotten advice from a fiduciary to buy this thing, so you purchased it. He didn't or she didn't sell it to you. You're compensating them somehow else. But the insurance company's not involved in that. If they are, it's only in taking a withdrawal from your account to pay the fiduciary. So how do they get paid? They want to get paid regardless of who sells the product, regardless of how the product is sold. If it's sold because it's under the advice of a fiduciary, they still want to get paid. If it's sold because a salesperson sells it for them, they still want to get paid. And if they have the ability to game the marketplace, it's going to cost them money to some extent, and that the fiduciaries are not going to recommend those products anymore. But as I said at the beginning of the fiduciary conversation, there aren't that many fiduciaries out there. So when you're talking pure profit, it doesn't make sense to pander to the fiduciaries, as much as I hate that. At the big company level, it doesn't make sense to pander to fiduciaries. I would really, really like to see the opposite side of that, but that's where it is right now. I've got to play some commercials. If you'd like to call in, I've got more to talk about on the recession side of things. That'll probably be next hour. The phone number in here is 254-773-1400. That's 254-773-1400. I'll be back on the other side. And I'm back. The wrong bumper music was playing. This is the, it's good stuff. It should have been this. All right. I am back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. I've only got a few minutes left this hour. This hour, we've got just over 2 minutes left. I wanted to hit one of the big pieces of news. The Labor Department came out with numbers on payrolls this week. Non-farm payrolls rose 130,000. What that means, 130,000 new jobs were created. That's a decent number, except when you start digging into it, it shows some negatives. It's a decent number also in that it just barely keeps up with our population replacement. So we've got people being born all the time and people dying all the time, and that kind of cycle is continuing. New jobs coming in at 130,000 in a month means that we're right at break even. That is the net job growth is the same as the net population growth. So our unemployment rate, unsurprisingly in that situation, remained 3.7%. When we dig into it, we hired about 27,000 people to work for the government, for the Census Bureau, because it's coming up on next year will be the time that the census gets done. This is a constitutional mandate, which means that if we didn't have the once in a decade hire spurt that takes place right now, we'd be right around 100,000 new jobs, and that's below population growth. That means that we would be moving backwards. And we're seeing stuff like that regularly enough to say that the economy is mature and getting tired. It's been running full speed for a long time, and it's now needing a rest. So we're about out of time for this hour. I'll talk about this more next hour. We'll go through the life cycle of a recession in more detail. If you'd like to contact us off the air, the Personal Wealth Coach does give personalized fiduciary investment advice to people of high net worth. The phone number to call locally is 254-947-1111. You can reach that number toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You'll see my made-for-radio face, my dad's gleaming pate covered by a cowboy hat, and a beautiful staff. We have newsletters there. We have recordings of the radio program going back quite a few years. Stop by, see us, email us through the site. Until next hour, this has been The Person.